Well, good afternoon. It's Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon on KTOO FM News in Juneau. Today we'll be talking with Brett Crawford. He'll be appearing in a solo recital this Sunday at Northern Light United Church. Beverly Schooner will drop by to highlight this week's Wild and Scenic Film Festival. Cheryl Levitt Snyder will be talking with Kate Glover and Rod Cadmus there on a Round the World Sailing Expedition. And Juneau School District should drop in and tell us a little bit more about the science fair. Weather calls for snow, mixed with rain late in the afternoon, additional snow accumulation 1 to 3 inches, which gives us a winter storm warning. Storm total snow accumulation 11 to 17 inches, highs around 35.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new report says gambling at Native American-run casinos in 2010 reversed a previous drop in revenues. As KGOU's Kurt Gwartney reports, the industry is showing new strength as the national economy improves.
The annual study Casino Cities Indian Gaming Industry Report said revenue at tribal casinos was $26.7 billion in 2010, up nearly 4% over 2009. The report says tribal casinos are now responsible for almost the same amount of casino gambling as commercial casinos. California leads the nation in Native American gaming, with Oklahoma coming in second. The author of the report, Alan Meister of Nathan Associates, estimates tribal gambling was responsible for more than 700,000 jobs and $29 billion in wages in 2010. He also says Native American casinos appeal to gamblers because they're newer and operate in markets with less competition. Tribal leaders say income from casinos funds more services and opportunities for their members. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
More than 60 mushers, including native mushers, are on the trail for the Iditarod Sled Dog Race, traveling miles across Alaska. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes spoke with some of the native mushers before the race, including John Baker and the Nupiaq Eskimo. He won last year with a record-setting 8 days, 18 hours, and 46 minutes. He says winning last year has affected how he feels about this race.
I guess I'm a little bit more confident. First of all, I have won the race, so I have an idea of what it'll take to win the race. And second of all, I have a lot of confidence in the team, so the way that I'm going to run the team is definitely to their advantage.
Yupik Eskimo Mike Williams Jr. says his team's in good shape.
They look good. The older dogs are, of course, relaxed. But as soon as we take out the harnesses and put them on the lines, they're going to get pretty riled up.
Williams' team has won. His father, longtime musher Mike Williams Sr., had planned to run this year. But Williams Sr. says he's not running the Iditarod on his doctor's advice.
He said, "You're getting healthier," but his recommendation was to stay home and stay home this year. So I decided to honor that and... And I'm still, healing from the bad pneumonia that I had, and hopefully I'll be healthy enough to do another one next year.
Placing in the race depends on the physical condition of the dogs and mushers and the musher's strategy, but weather and trail conditions are also important. Pete Kaiser of Yupik descent says race officials told them sections of the trail are covered with several feet of snow.
Sometimes deep snow can mean that that there's a trail, and if a few teams go over it, they can break the trail up, and that teams behind them can have a harder time getting through that. Sometimes it also means that early teams can kind of put in a trail. If the temperature changes just right, they can make a base to the trail, and later teams will have an advantage.
Athabascan Josh Cazzo is competing in his first Iditarod, and he's encouraging Native youth to follow their dreams.
For the younger Native people, if you really want to do something like this, your people will have your back, guaranteed. They got mine, so that's a good, let's go for it.
The race kicked off over the weekend. During this week in 2009, Carrie Dan, a member of the Western Shoshone tribe, and Manny Pino, a member of Acoma Pueblo, were recognized for their work to protect sacred areas. Dan and Pino received the Human Rights Defenders Award by the International Indian Treaty Council. They were honored during the Indigenous People's Struggles to Defend Sacred Places Symposium held at San Francisco State University. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIC, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's in 15 seconds or so, it'll be 6 minutes after 3, and you're in tune with KTOO News. We are looking at a weather forecast that includes a winter storm warning right now. It'll be in effect until 5 p.m. today. And this afternoon, we're looking at this rain mixed with snow. We're looking at maybe an additional snow accumulation of 1 to 3 inches. That will be a total of about 11 to 17 inches for the whole event. Highs around 35, southeast winds 10 to 25 miles per hour. We'll have higher gusts. It's been a little windy today, kind of blowing the snow right into you. Rain and snow this evening, then rain. The snow accumulation up to an inch tonight. Snow levels increasing to maybe 1,200 feet late. And the lows around 33, southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. And then Wednesday, rain, possibly mixed with some snow in the morning. Little or no snow accumulation, though, in the highs around 38. Southeast winds, southwest winds, 10 to 35 miles per hour on Wednesday. So there's a little weather to look forward to. A major shock for southeast Alaska. Rain never happens, right? I have a guest from southeast Alaska, and I have a guest from outside who will be performing this Sunday. Brett Crawford is here with us, tenor from here in Juneau, and Janice Capel, his accompanist from outside. So what are you going to be doing Sunday? What's the plan?
I plan to do a vocal recital of some oratorio music, something from the Messiah. The title of the recital is Some of My Favorite Things.
Hmm.
And I'm doing some opera, some arias from La Boheme, from The Elixir of Love, and from Turandot, the Nessun Dorma, typical classical tenor aria from Nessun Dorma, which is absolutely my favorite aria. Mm-hmm. Doing a spiritual called Where Were You There, and some things from Broadway in the second half after the intermission. A couple of duets, two with my wife, my lovely wife, Cheryl.
Mm.
And we've done some things together. And then one with Dan Wayne. And one with Derek Grimes, who was with me in La Boheme last fall. We're going to reprise that duet that we did in the fourth act in La Boheme.
So are you just finding out what he's planning on doing, Janice, or did you know in advance?
I've known in advance, and we've been working together since last April on this repertoire, and performed it once down in Texas, in Athens, Texas, on the 19th of February of this year as a dress rehearsal for our performance this Sunday.
So this opened on in Texas and now is playing on the big stage here in Juneau.
You got it.
There you go.
Good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a couple of questions as you were talking about this. Why is that your favorite aria?
It is very emotional. It is very powerful. And it goes up to high be natural.
And
it's that typical, you know, tenor.
Tenor, yeah.
Although I've sung other arias that go up to Cs. But it just... And... Jan and I did this a couple of years ago at a workshop, and it was such a mountaintop experience that it's just kind of become my aria. So, for me to do.
I'm not sure you can tell us. How does a B natural feel from inside?
It's all head tone
by then.
It is. Yeah. It is. So, and you have to have it very open, and it's
how do you
quite
warm
exhilarating.
How do you warm up for it?
I do vocalizing scales and getting my voice relaxed and keeping it nice and warm and opening my throat a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely keeping the support with the air. But there's a lot of mental involved not getting too tight, keeping relaxed.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I believe that it was Caruso, the famous tenor, who was asked, what does it feel like to sing a high C? And he said it was like my little toe was vibrating.
It's wonderful.
As I recall.
It's wonderful. It's something like that.
It is quite amazing, actually.
Yeah. Yes, and afterward you get kind of an adrenaline rush out of it.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're spent.
Yeah.
After you.
So you're going to do that near the end of the performance, right?
Actually, toward the end of the middle.
Ah, okay.
So
you can go out and relax a little bit.
Yeah.
Right before intermission.
Okay, good.
No,
well,
it's that.
We don't want you passing out on stage or anything like that. So, the other thing that I noticed that you chose a song that's a Lenten piece. Appropriate timing. Were you there? Negro spiritual, but sung very often in churches through this through the season we're in right now.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you deliberately choose a religious piece to have in the thing? I know you're doing this in Northern Light United Church, but it's not like you're paying dues or anything, is it?
A lot of spirituals are a number of my favorites, but it is especially meaning this time of year, mm-hmm. being a believer. And I just have sung in church all my life, and my wife and I met in the choir.
It also dovetails well from the sacred Messiah and Elijah pieces that we start with, oratorio, keeping in the sacred vein, and then on into the art songs, and being that it can be considered folk. And so it's just a way of transitioning from the sacred into the folk and art songs.
You know, the Messiah has Easter components as well as Christmas components.
Exactly.
So you're concentrating on the upcoming season, I take it? Okay.
Right. I'm working on some things for that as well.
Don't sing any hallelujahs. They're not permitted for another, another 30 days, I think, 20 days. Anyway, so the two of you began rehearsing this, you said, how long ago, Jan?
April of last year.
April. So when you're putting this kind of thing together, there's the relationship between the two of you is almost like a dancer. We were talking about that just a little bit in advance, but it's like, in your case, the roles are reversed, because in many ways, your role is to make him really look good.
Absolutely.
But in order to pull that off, you don't just play the score. I mean, it's not like you're just playing note for note off
the
page.
Well, if you play just the score, you don't always get much music.
Right.
You execute it, in fact,
uh-huh.
literally and figuratively, which is not the best thing. We're looking to make music and bring it to life. And it does not come to life by just looking at the spots,
mm-hmm.
the dots.
How does it change?
Well,
as the two of you are working the piece, what kinds of shifts do you find yourself doing?
Well, number one, I think that you have to consider being attuned to that person. And the best advice I was given back in college when I was a music student was, you have to breathe with the music. You have to let the music breathe. And generally, that means that you're breathing with the singer. And so if you have somebody holding it there, you know that you're doing the same darn thing. So you know that they're hesitant to begin if they hold at the apex of the breath. But as opposed to, they're ready to go. And so you feel the flow of it. You have to be attuned to them. So it's a very intuitive process, one that is amazing to me, because I don't consider it my talent necessarily, maybe a nature situation that one can do it if they put themselves in the right frame of mind. But it's a following, so in a sense, I'm trying to make him look good, let him do what he's going to do, and not step on his toes, but actually go with his flow.
Brett, what do you learn from Jan when the two of you are working together?
Oh, it's... She has brought so much to this project. I tell people, if it hadn't been for my wife and Scarlett, Adam, and Jan, it wouldn't have happened, because she really... We sat down and looked at the music, or she did, and we talked about flow and how the music flows and the relationship of the character in the music, what it's saying and what it's saying at a particular time, and giving me... coaching on going through a particular phrase.
Trying to free him, basically, of the technical and thinking too much oftentimes.
Yeah.
If you, us overachievers get in our own way, and we try and pray that we're going to not get in the way and that it does come through the way instruments are supposed to.
Well, this chance to hear the freedom the two of you have developed and the cooperation between the two of you will be available to Juno audiences at 3 o'clock on Sunday at Northern Light United Church.
Yes.
Tickets are available through the usual outlets around
yes.
town, the Jack, I assume,
yes.
and probably Heritage and like that. Okay,
yes,
so 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, Northern Light United Church, Brett Crawford with some of my favorite songs, some of
yes.
my favorite things, and Janice Capel yes. accompanying him on the piano. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
Pat.
You.
A great song is occasionally the work of a great composer, and one of the great composers of songs that we all know died early today, Robert Sherman, whose music you are about to hear, and I'm sure you will recognize it.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious. If you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Because I was afraid to speak when I was just a lad. My father gave me nails that week and told me I was bad. But then one day I learned a word that saved me aching nose.
The biggest word you ever heard, and this is how it goes. Oh, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. He traveled all around the world, and everywhere he went, he'd use his word, and all would say, "There goes a clever gent."
When Dukes and Martha Rogers pass a time of day with me, I say me special word, and then they ask me off to tea.
Woo!
But that's going a bit too far, don't you think?
Indubitably.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay.
Here
just summon up this word, and then you've got a lot to say. But better use it carefully, or it could change your life.
For example?
Yes?
One night I said it to me girl, and now me girl's me wife. Oh, and a lovely thing she is, too.
Music composed by Richard and Robert Sherman. Robert Sherman died this morning. Fabulous pieces that we all remember from our childhood and the childhood of those that we've shown the videotapes over and over and over and over to as we come along through life.
Programming support comes from the Juno Empire's Job Fair, working to connect employers and employees, accepting employer booth registration till March 16th. More information on booth space at 586-3740.
Beverly Schoonover is here in the studio with me, and she is going to tell us about a wild and scenic film festival that is coming up this week.
Hi. Thanks for having us. Good.
Hey, my pleasure.
So this is our third year that the Juno Watershed Partnership has been able to bring the Wild and Scenic Film Festival to Juno. It's a national environmental film festival, and we get granting through Patagonia and the Foggy Mountain Shop, actually
mm-hmm.
locally here, to bring this festival here. And it's happening this Thursday, March 8th, at the Jack. Usually we have it at Centennial Hall, so it is switching this year to the Jack. We're really excited about it. And we have two film festivals. We're going to have a really family-friendly kids festival starting at 6 p.m. this Thursday. And then the all-ages festival start at 7:30.
I noticed in the films, are you going to be able to show, there's a 72-minute film in the festival about the porcupine caribou herd. Is that one of the ones we'll
no.
get here?
And Smoking Fish by Corey Mann
yeah.
is an official selection of the festival as well, and that's 85 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And the total festival is about 2 hours long, so we get little short
so
guides.
Short
I think
one,
our mm-hmm. shortest one is a minute and a half, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
What makes these films wild and scenic? Why do they have that title?
You know, it's really evolved over the years. This year, it was really a very heavy emphasis on activism and how, you know, kids, how, you know, quote-unquote disenfranchised folks in the remote corners of the world can really stand up and make a big difference in their community. There was one, I shouldn't even bring it up, because I can't remember the title of the name, but they're, A Leader of Light. It's one of the most beautiful little films, and it's in an Indian slum, and they use water bottles and a little bit of tin to create these natural lights inside these dwelling places, and it doesn't cost any energy. It's reusing water bottles, and it's really improved the lifestyle and living of folks there. It's just a simple idea, but you know, has huge consequences. It's a really great film. Some of the kids' films we're showing, there's a really great one called Gloop. It's sort of talking about the discovery of plastic and sort of what plastic was intended for, and now sort of where in 2012 we find plastic. There's a really great movie called Look to the Ground, and it's about a legally blind downhill mountain bike racer, and it's amazing. And of course you see him wipe out, you see him make, you know, the most amazing jumps. He has someone that follows right behind him and kind of gives him, you know, oral clues of where to go, and he races mountain bikes downhill. It's a really great film.
The person who follows behind him's got an interesting job.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he does bite it at one point. He's like, I feel so bad for the people that I'm working with. They have to realize that it's me. It's not them.
Mm-hmm.
In the All Ages Festival, the Rendezvous and the Brewing Company are sponsoring a beer garden. So you can come and sit and have a beer and watch movies, which I know is sort of a rare thing here in Juneau. Our feature film is a film called Kodoma, and I'm really glad I picked this movie, but I do believe it was shown at the Telluride Festival here. It is the kind of movie where I was sitting at my desk previewing it, just bawling my heads out, and I'm not a big crier. It's a story about an ill-fated whitewater trip down the Congo, and, you know, it was shot as, you know, this documentary of these Western guys coming to the Congo to river raft, and, you know, something happens and it turns into this much more engaging story about, you know, why do people do these risky things out in the environment? Why do they take these risks, and what does it mean? We also have this great film by an old buddy of mine, which is kind of exciting, Into Darkness, a guy by the name of John Waller who lives in Portland. It's a caving film. It's about going into caves in Oregon and talking once again about why people choose to do these, you know, interact with the nature the way they do. And at one point there's a caver kind of stuck in a crevice and it's very uncomfortable for me to watch. But it's a great movie.
I might have to set that one out.
Yeah, for sure. The one thing I love about this festival is that local groups partner and help us. So, for example, Discovery Southeast, the Juneau Raptor Center, Alaska Wildlife Alliance, and Turning the Tides during the Family Fest are coming. They're bringing a live bird. They're having all sorts of hands-on. Discovery Southeast is going to do a hands-on watershed activity. There's a bunch of free giveaways. Our national sponsors, we have like 200 Cliff Bars to get rid of, and we've got Osprey packs and clean canteens, and this is all part of the program. So it's just a really great event.
And what time does it start?
It starts the Family Festival, which we expect lots of kids to come. They can run around, zoo out, play, look at the bird, watch some movies. That starts at 6 p.m. Thursday at the Jack. Doors open at 5:30. And then doors open for the All Ages Festival at 7. That's when our beer garden opens. And then the films start at 7:30.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said something in the middle of that whole thing. You said, I picked this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, Beverly, it sounds like you get to see all. Do you see the whole catalog and then choose what you want for the show? Are you the person who makes those decisions?
It's pretty much, besides like pre-testing the granola bars to make sure that they're fresh. It's probably
that
the best.
That was Kevin. Okay.
Definitely, it's probably the best job of my best task of the year at the Watershed Partnership, and I think they have like probably 30 or 40, and then I screen probably 20 of those, and we can see them on Vimeo, or, you know, we have kind of a secret channel that we can go watch them. And I also ask my board to watch them, and they enjoy that, especially I have parents on the board.
Who else on your board? You probably have a big board.
Oh, yeah. We've got a great board.
How many people?
We have 9 right now.
Oh, okay.
We have folks, contractors. We've got a couple people working for Fish and Game, DEC, Forest Sciences Lab, DOT, the National Weather Service, the CBJ Harbor, CBJ Community Development. I know I'm missing someone.
You're really drawing from a broad cross-section of the Juneau community.
Juneau Watershed Partnership has one of the best boards, I think, ever.
What else, besides bringing us all of these fine movies, does the Watershed Partnership do?
We have had a really busy year. This is our main fundraiser, but we have a lot of stuff coming up. We're monitoring Lena Beach and Coleman Beach Auk Rec for fecal coliform this summer. We monitor Jordan Creek. We were doing a habitat conservation plan for the Peterson Hill area. The city was maybe talking about doing a plan unit development up there. We were working with them to say, okay, if you do something up here, here's the footprint of the wetlands, and here's the footprint of where the water contributes to the salmon streams, and don't put a house there. And that was a really great project. This year we've got funding to work with folks to go out to 5 or 6 of our watersheds and do field investigations and look at potential restoration, enhancement, and mitigation. Mm-hmm. So one of our big ones is the Mendenhall River. We want to work with all the landowners there and the city and look at erosion and what are some long-term plans of, if we're going to have these, I can't pronounce the name, these big ice floods, glacial ice floods.
I understand. I can't do it either.
But, yeah, what can we do to protect?
It's that thing that happened this last summer when the thing, Icelandic word, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, okay.
And doing that, and then we also got funding to work with partners to try to reduce garbage and pollution in Montana Creek. And especially like in the parking lots and stuff like that. So we've got a ton on board this year. We are recruiting for an executive director. It's sort of closed on the 29th, but if anyone is particularly thrilled by that announcement, they can email us at jwp@alaska.net. And we're also hosting a forum this week, which if we have got time.
Forum? Okay. Yeah, we do. We have a minute or so.
Oh, great. With the National Forest Foundation, the watershed groups in Southeast Alaska are part of a coalition, and we're hosting a community-based watershed management forum. And basically, it's stuff like this. It's getting people together to talk about local watershed issues, wetland management plans, getting folks together to talk about invasive weeds and how communities in Southeast Alaska can do that more effectively. And this is free and open for the public. It's March 8th and 9th at the Baranoff Hotel in the Treadwell Ballroom. And if people are wondering, what is community-based watershed management? What's happening in the region? If you stop by the Treadwell Ballroom at 5:30 on March 8th, that's Thursday before the film festival. Mm-hmm. You can see posters from people around the region doing on-the-ground watershed restoration and enhancement work.
In just a few moments, I'm going to be talking to someone about the science fair. Do you know of any science fair, any students that did work with the watershed?
I hope so. We have a special award. Daniel Melville, who is the son of the folks who own Capital Copy, he passed away a couple years ago, and we have a special award for him, which is Eco Hydrology Exploration Award. And basically it's anything that makes you go, wow, that's pretty cool.
So
we have 2 awards, and hopefully there are some really great wow projects at the science fair.
Cool. Okay. Well, one more time, the Wild and Scenic Film Festival is coming up. It's Thursday. The kids' part starts between at 6 o'clock, and during that you have activities as well as a set of short children's films. And then at 7 o'clock, you're opening the door for the All Ages Festival with the movies starting at 7:30. There are door prizes, Clif bars,
giveaways,
and water bottles galore, and all sorts of stuff like that.
Tickets are $10 for adults, $5 for students 6 to 18, and then kids under 5 are free.
And seniors are also at the reduced rate of $5.
Of course.
It says here. Okay. So, and there will be a beer garden, so it's a chance to sit and watch great movies about on wild and scenic topics while sipping something good from the Alaska Brewery. All right. Thank you very much for coming down and telling us all.
Thanks so much for having us.
This is Bird Note. To protect passengers, planes, and birds at Seattle's SeaTac Airport, biologist Steve Osmek and Bud Anderson capture, relocate, and monitor the travels of red-tailed hawks. The birds are banded, wing-tagged, and released 80 miles north of the airfield. Steve Osmek explains the importance of marking the birds so they can be identified.
One of the main reasons that we're doing this study is because there's been a long debate among airports and airport biologists that it may not be a wise thing to be trapping and relocating raptors, because there could be a tendency for these birds to come back to airfields. And so in order to test this theory, it made a lot of sense to us to make sure that we mark every bird. One, you can tell without a question if you have a problem bird that continues to return. But the other thing is what it's telling us is that these birds are not going to other airfields with any more frequency than they're going to other places. These birds seem to be distributing quite randomly and widely. And I really believe they go to the areas where the prey is greatest. They go where the living is easiest, like most any person would do. You take the easiest way out, and that's where you go.
Bud Anderson describes the results of their work.
And to date, it's been phenomenal. We've moved something like 82 of these tagged birds. We've had resightings of 40% of those, so they're showing up all over, anywhere from Victoria on Vancouver Island, Vancouver, BC, all the way down to south of Portland. So these guys move everywhere, and almost none of them come back to the airport. So we're learning that the program's very effective.
To learn more about SeaTac Airport's raptor study, come to our website, birdnote.org.
It's 28 minutes to 4, and you're in tune with KTOO News. We have a special recorded program coming up next. A couple from who stayed quite a bit of time in Juneau, Juneau residents Kate Glover and Rob Cadmus, are now 9 months into what they figure to be a 3-year journey. They plan to sail clear around the world. And Cheryl Snyder caught up with them via Skype while they are wintering in Costa Rica.
Hey, how's it going?
Tell us about the you're on.
Well, we, a number of years ago, bought a 32-foot West Sail cutter and did a bunch of work on her and got her ready to go. And in last spring, we quit our jobs there in Juneau and loaded her up, and we started to head south. And we don't actually have a set destination. We may or may not go all the way around the world. We may just head into the South Pacific and then back to Juneau, but we'll kind of play that one stretch at a time. And so we've been sailing south since May, and so far it's been great. We've seen a lot of interesting things and met great people and lots of different wildlife for us, so it's been a great time.
How many years had you been planning on doing this kind of trip?
Well, Rob, I think, has been dreaming of this for at least the past 6 or 7 years. I didn't really jump into the plans until about 2 years ago. We've been seriously saving and plotting for about 2 years before we pushed off from the docks.
And what kind of sailing experience did you have?
Well, I moved down to Juneau from Fairbanks, and when I moved down, it was a decision both of a job, but also did I want to get a dog team or did I want to get a sailboat? And when I chose Juneau, I bought a sailboat, and I had done a little bit of sailing before then, but that was really my first intro into it. And so I raced a bunch with the Southeast Alaska Sailing Club, and we took it out and toured around Southeast. And so just before we took off, you know, I had 6 years of just sailing around Southeast, and Kate had less than that. And so we are, you could say we're a little bit green, or were when we left. And this will be our first large open water crossing. It's about, from the Galapagos to French Polynesia, is about 3,000 miles of open water.
Wow. So what sorts of things do you need to think about in doing that kind of crossing?
Well, I think the thing we're most worried about, actually, is just keeping ourselves busy, getting ourselves on a schedule where we get a little bit of exercise, where we're doing things throughout the day, because it's pretty easy to get lethargic when it's hot and we're moving slowly and there's not a whole lot going on. But what we've been working on now is just making sure that everything on the boat is in order, making sure all the rigging is in good shape, all the sails are in good shape, and learning more about tropical weather. We've learned along the way down that the weather here is very different from the weather in Juneau, not just in terms of rain and temperature, but I think the weather is less subtle in around Southeast Alaska than it is here. You look at a weather map and it looks scary, but here much smaller things can turn into big scary storms. So we're still learning a little about the weather and picking the right window for our crossing, but the biggest thing will just be how do we survive actually being on a boat together for 25 days.
That's how long you're anticipating it's going to take to go the 3,000 miles?
With luck.
So what are some of the survival strategies?
Well, we have a bike. That's the main one. Rob and his friend, before we left, we bought a folding bike, and Rob and his friend set it up so that you can use it as a stationary bike inside the boat. And it also, it's hooked up to an alternator, so it also charges the battery. But we use that to get a little bit of exercise, and it's as boring as can be, and it's really hot, but you feel like a real person again afterwards. So that's survival strategy number one, is getting exercise. Number two is either jumping overboard or dumping a lot of buckets of water on our heads. And I think after that,
I'd say the next big one is just figuring out the sleeping schedule, because you're moving 24 hours a day. You know, your sails are always up, and the boat can steer itself if there's good wind. We have a self-steering system that'll take care of the helm, but you have to be on board, making sure you're not running into anything and checking your positions and those sort of things. And so someone's up all the time, and so your sleep schedule gets really disjointed. And so figuring out the best arrangement where you have enough time to sleep, but somebody's up all the time and eating, and that arrangement takes a little bit of time to hone in, and it takes a few days before you really get in kind of sync of what works.
So, and will you be fishing along the way for some of your meals?
We'll be trying to. We're terrible fishermen. I think we've
can you actually say that coming from Southeast Alaska? Is that legal to say?
Probably not.
The best fish we've caught the whole trip was a king salmon outside of Sitka. And we did catch a Dorado or a mahi-mahi off of Baja, but it was big enough, and there was only two of us, and we don't have a refrigerator, that we actually let it go because it was we thought the fish would spoil, and it was just too nice of a fish to waste for that.
Actually, I woke up in the middle of the night to Rob yelling, "I caught a fish!" And then he said, "It's too pretty. I have to let it go."
That's great. So do you feel like the sailing you did in Southeast Alaska has prepared you for the conditions you've faced so far in your trip?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, it's been a lot of we've been out for so long now that we've seen a lot more things and a lot bigger weather and such. But sailing Southeast is really good prep. You know, the wind changes very suddenly there, so you're always moving your sails around. You can get a lot of storms. You've got to pay attention to the weather because it can sneak up on you. So, I think it did. And, you know, and looking back in Southeast, there's some really awesome things about Southeast sailing as well. I mean, the anchorages there are just fantastic and secure and safe, and the wildlife and the clean water. And so It was definitely worth its while and a great place to learn, and we'll be happy to come back as well.
What have been some of the major highlights of your travels these last many months?
I think one of the ongoing highlights for us is wildlife, both land-based wildlife and marine mammals, but the dolphins in particular. We've had dolphins swimming along with us probably more days than we haven't, and that's always a real treat. You can hear them when they're swimming next to the boat.
What does it sound like when they're swimming by the boat?
Well, they're talking to each other. You hear the little squeaks and clicks they make when they're talking. Especially if you're below the deck, you can hear them sort of through the hull of the boat. And sometimes when we're really lucky at night, they come and swim with us when there's phosphorescence, and so you have these glowing dolphin comets rocketing past the boat, and it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
It never gets old.
Yeah. But I think our other highlights, Southeast Alaska was still was one of the highlights, especially in Glacier Bay. We had, at one point I said, "I'm going to find a bear," and 5 minutes later I saw one, and you have sort of wildlife on demand in Southeast Alaska, and that's always a treat.
I'd say some other highlights would be Haida Gwaii in BC, the cultural aspects of some of the old village sites. Actually, the Channel Islands in California were a really nice place and different wildlife there as well. Mm-hmm. The Baja Peninsula was gorgeous. And we would definitely spend more time in the Sea of Cortez and Baja. A place called Isla Isabel, which was an amazing bird sanctuary, and there was frigate birds and blue-footed boobies just feet away from us, and that was spectacular. And then Central America's had some amazing spots along the way, particularly lots of monkeys and some nice hikes as well.
And I think an actual sailing highlight for us was coming back across Hecate Strait from Haida Gwaii. That was our first real big open water crossing, and as we came across, we had the northern lights glowing all night above our heads, and the wind picked up until it was more than we were quite sure we were ready to handle, but we were cruising along at what felt like light speed under the northern lights and a full moon, and we were pretty proud of ourselves when we made it into the mainland after that, so I think that was also a good highlight.
Sounds really magical. Any hard-learned lessons out there?
Yeah, coming down from Seattle to San Francisco, we do in one long push. The harbors along the way are all river entries, so when the waves get really bad, they get really, really bad. And so we just stayed 200 miles offshore. And the biggest lesson with that is reading a weather map. And sometimes high pressure systems are not always your friend. And we got caught in what was called a squash zone, where a high pressure system butts up against a low pressure system, and we had some pretty big winds and seas on that trip, and we probably won't make that mistake again. Well, hopefully we'll make that mistake again.
So you guys are preparing to head off for 25 days of open water crossing. Your plan is to set out tomorrow?
Oh no, we've got a few more days of work on the boat, and then we're going to go explore a little bit of Costa Rica, go do some hikes and possibly paddle some rivers, and then we'll wait and watch the weather and go jump through a lot of hoops to get our ZARPE, it's called. It's our permit to leave Costa Rica. And it'll be a couple weeks yet before we go, but it'll get there soon.
So if people want to follow along with your travels, you guys are keeping a blog. Can you tell people how they find the blog?
Sure. It's watchingtelltales.com.
Okay. And how often are you able to update that blog?
It varies. I was updating it fairly frequently when we started, but I've been falling off of it. It ends up being every couple of weeks usually. It may be less frequent once we get off the mainland. I think they have less wireless availability there.
Great. Well, Cake Lover and Rob Cadmus, it's been fantastic talking with you today in sunny Costa Rica. And hopefully when you guys are on land again after your big crossing, we can connect up and find out how it went.
Great. Well, thank you, and it was nice talking to you as well.
All right. Best of luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cheryl Snyder talking with Kate Glover and Rob Cadmus, who are on a round-the-world cruise. They're in Costa Rica right now and will be coming back to us possibly in about another 6 months. The winter storm warning has been canceled. They're saying now that the rain and snow will change to all rain this evening with a little patchy fog, and the snow accumulation will be less than 1 inch. The snow level increasing to 800 feet in the late evening, and temperatures steady around 34 degrees, southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 6th of March, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist who said, "What matters in life is not what happens to you, but what you remember and how you remember it." Gabriel Garcia Marquez, born in Aracataca, Colombia, 1927, grew up with his maternal grandparents, the grandfather a colonel, military hero, his grandmother a wonderful storyteller. His grandfather told him stories of the Revolution, and his grandmother told stories of ghosts and curses and magic. Garcia Marquez went to university, studied law, went to work as a journalist, writing stories on the side. And just before his 23rd birthday, he traveled back to Aracataca with his mother to help her sell his grandparents' house. and he was inspired by the town to create a fictional town named Macondo, the setting of his epic novel 100 Years of Solitude. In 1985 came his novel Love in the Time of Cholera. Marquez remembered with pleasure the years he was writing that book. He said, I would get up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, listen to the news, read from 6 to 8, write from 8 till 1. By midday, my wife would go to the beach and wait for me with friends. After lunch, I had a little siesta, and when the sun started going down, I would go out on the street to look for places where my characters would go, to talk to people and pick up language and atmosphere. It's the birthday of Ring Lardner, born Niles, Michigan, 1885. Wrote about the Chicago Cubs and White Sox for the Chicago Tribune, covered baseball all over the Midwest. Wrote a daily column, and one day, in desperation, he wrote a fictional dialogue between two ballplayers playing poker, which was a success, and he began writing in the voice of a player named Jack Keefe, who sent letters home to his friend Al Blanchard. They were published in the book You Know Me, Al. Ring Lardner, who wrote, he looked at me as if I were a side dish he hadn't ordered. It's the birthday of the soldier Cyrano de Bergerac, born in Paris, 1619, famous in his day for his heroism on the battlefield and also his writing, fought in several battles, survived a stab wound in the neck, studied astronomy, and wrote a satirical novel about traveling to the moon, and centuries later became the subject of the play Cyrano de Bergerac by the French playwright Edmond Rostand, who had read a description of Cyrano that said that his nose was large, and that Cyrano had once written letters for a fellow soldier to help him court a lady. So Rostand invented a tragic love story in which Cyrano is forced to secretly write letters to Roxanne, the woman he loves, for a fellow soldier. The play was a huge hit in France. Audience loved it so much on opening night, the standing ovation lasted for a full hour. There were 40 bows at the curtain. Here's a poem for today by Greg Hewitt, When I Lost My Hands. When I lost my hands, I started wearing gloves, the kind pallbearers wear, thin and yellowed. When I lost my hands, I started to stare at my father, lifting his wine glass like a dancer would a rose, at my aunt, shuffling cards, brittle veins almost breaking against the aquamarine on her knuckle, at my grandfather holding his guitar, not so much like a lover as like a god who has touched the earth. When I lost my hands, I started to see how doves fold their wings over their backs like hands in prayer. When I lost my hands, I could no longer pray. When I lost my hands, I could no longer speak. A poem by Greg Hewitt, When I Lost My Hands, from Reb Suburb, published by Coffee House Press, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Written by Betsy Allister, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 11 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. My guest is David Lendrum. He was here last week, and we talked about the topic that we're going to reiterate today because it's really coming up this weekend, and that is the Southeast Alaska Science Fair.
Southeast Alaska Regional Science Fair.
Yes, okay.
Which makes us then eligible to participate in the state, national, and international fairs.
All right, so when we say regional, we're covering what communities?
Several schools.
Uh-huh.
Our Southeast Alaska region. And this year there will be kids from Petersburg and Angoon as well as Skagway.
So now the entries have all been logged in. We know who's going to actually display
We know all of them. They're all here. Okay. They're all anxiously pushing themselves forward.
What kinds of things are we going? Now, wait, first, there is an open house at TMHS for the public to be able to see all of these
exhibits.
There
are two of them.
Two of them.
The first
one's
Friday evening from 5 to 8:30. And the students won't be there. Some of them will, but they're not required to be.
Right.
And if you want to walk through and look at them all, and that's kind of the, there's less pressure and less anxiety then. And then there's again on Saturday, and that's from 11 to 12. And, it's from 12 to 1:30.
12 to 1:30, okay.
12 to 1:30 is the public time.
Okay.
And then the kids will be there, and they will have been judged, and they'll have some idea of how well they've done, and they're all primed up by then. They have given their spiel about their project several times to different judges coming through, and so they're well-practiced and they're ready, and they're all attentive and eager and ready to talk about their project.
For anyone who hasn't walked through the science fair, this is really it's a wonderful experience because there are these young kids, and they're all like juniors, sophomores, juniors, seniors, and some freshmen, I guess. They're all in the 4 years of high school, and you don't expect their eagerness until you walk in there, and they've got this sparkle in their eye that, you know, they've done something.
Oh, and it's really, really inspirational.
It's really inspirational. You walk through, and they're anxious to tell you the story of the experiment that they ran.
And this year there will be students from middle schools, too, around the Southeast.
Oh, okay.
And they're at every bit as charged up.
Uh-huh.
And I told you before that a couple years ago, one of the students from the middle school in Skagway won his 4-year college scholarship there.
Wow.
It was very exciting.
He was
skipping and running right down the avenue to get his award. Yeah. His parents were standing up high-fiving.
Yeah.
They were thrilled.
Yeah,
he was thrilled.
They were.
Oh, you bet they were.
So what kinds of things are we
exciting projects?
Yeah, what kinds of things are we going to see?
Well, here's one that says how feeding after a period of starvation affects the RNA-DNA ratio of juvenile capuchin over time.
Huh. Okay.
And how racing suits affect swimming speed. And how do different fruits affect gelatin solidification?
Okay, now wait. Notice in every one of these, that word effect is in there. So notice here that these are not like an encyclopedia article or something like that. The students are looking at causation. And in order to be able to answer the question that's implied by one of those descriptions, they have to actually work with the thing that they're talking about. They have to set up control groups. They have to set up the experiment. They have to run it. They have to take observations. They have to measure things. And at the end, they have to write a piece that shows this and do conclusions and all like that. That's the scientific method, and that's really the heart of what makes the science fair this exciting thing, because it's students doing science right there in front of you, you know.
Oh, and one of the most critical things about doing science is to remember that you never prove anything.
No, you disprove.
But also that word effect. You find that, yes, there are things that affect something else, but you can't be really, really, really sure, you know, because, you know, 10 years down the line, a new technology is going to open the door and say, no, it's not the amount of gold in the water, it's the amount of chlorine in the water, or something like that.
What is it? Niels Bohr said, the truth is something that we can disprove, but we can never prove it, or something, something I'm paraphrasing badly.
Just like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're all looking forward to it. I mean, it's not just, oh, curiosity and let's go down and see some big science. It's much more the interpersonal stuff.
Well, the other aspect of this, too, is a lot of times, and there's a lot of the science fair exhibits where some student has had to build a piece of apparatus that just didn't exist to make the experiment work. And so there's this construction that they've got, and they bring it to the fair. It's sitting there on the table in front of you.
Not only that, there are a special prize allotted just for that phase. There's one from the Mechanical Engineering Society for whoever does construct the best one, and not necessarily the best one. You know, there's a whole series of awards for them. And there's one from the International Society of Measurement, having to do with making sure that all the measurements are correct and expressed correctly and down to the correct decimal point for whatever their application is.
Mm-hmm.
There's awards from the Weather Society and from the Army Research Group, all kinds of people that you don't really think about as being supportive of high school science.
Now, and that's what we talked about last time, is the fact that this is a community that really comes out in support of our students who are pursuing scientific observation and experimentation. Because the prizes, one of them's from a floral. It seems to me the Master Gardeners give a prize out there at the fair.
I'm the president of the Master Gardener Association. Well, so, I mean, my term in office ended 2 months ago, so I am the ex-president.
You're the former president.
That's right. But so excited to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And lots of small businesses in Juneau give awards having to do with their particular interest.
Clubs and organizations, same kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Electrical contractors, plenty of building contractors do.
Yeah.
You know, and
then there's the really big support that comes from organizations like NOAA and the other. But those are the local folks who are standing up there and encouraging our students to be involved in scientific careers.
That's, and going to the awards ceremony and seeing who are the faces behind all those awards, you know, those people are not just pleased. They're ecstatically proud to be able to offer an award and to have sponsored, insofar as they're doing just for that small time, sponsored some student on their way to scientific exploration. And, you know, it's a part of a rite of passage, too.
Yes.
And they do it as they arrange the audience. When you look from the podium down, the first 20 rows are all kids.
Yeah.
It's not their parents. They're presenting in front of their peers. And they're acting in front of their peers. It's actually pretty carefully arranged that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, again, the same observation I made last time when you and I were talking about this. We are, this community is so involved in this science fair thing, and we orchestrate it really well. We owe that, a lot of that, to the folks who put it together over the years. Mr. Smith, I think, from
Mr. Smith, Lawrence Schaffler,
those folks were the spark plugs behind this thing and really put it together so that it works extremely well. Yeah,
and of course Nancy Waterman and Bill Meadey, they were the ones that really, together with John Smith, were the ones that really got it off the ground to start with. And now what you're seeing is a whole nother wave, and we are. The science fair is actually being funded from the amount of monies that we collected last year.
Uh-huh.
So when you come, if you feel like adding some donation to the ongoing science fair, there will be a collection plate or a collection basket there where you walk in and begin looking around. And they would welcome some other contribution because it all comes out of somebody's pocket.
Yeah,
you know?
Any sense of what it costs to put the science fair on?
Oh, thousands.
Yeah.
Because they then
and that's not part of the school budget.
Oh, no.
No.
The school budget doesn't pay anything for this.
This is the science fair organization that funds this whole deal.
And then the kids have to go off, the winning children,
students,
young adults, go off with some chaperone and mentor to the next phase.
Uh-huh.
First to Anchorage, then Philadelphia, and then Stockholm.
Yeah. So, the Stockholm trip. Wow. Wouldn't that be wonderful if it came from Juneau? Anyway.
A young woman did last year.
Yeah, it has. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the science fair, the students.
Friday and Saturday.
The exhibits have to be up when?
Oh, they're up by Friday in the late afternoon.
Okay. And then the judges come in and start looking at them.
Saturday morning.
So, Friday night is a chance to look at the exhibits, but probably no students or few students present at that time.
Some will absolutely be there because they just can't stand to be away from it.
Okay. And then Saturday in the morning, they're being judged. All the decisions will be made and everything. And then at 12 o'clock, they open the doors to the public, and it's open until 1:30.
Right.
And then the awards ceremony out at the university is?
In the library building down in the basement.
Starts at 7 o'clock. Okay, good. And it usually lasts about an hour and a half.
Yeah, 7 to 8:30 is just about right.
Right. Okay.
And everybody walks out with a grin.
Yeah, yeah. So this is Science Fair weekend in Juneau. Everybody put that on your calendar and go out and support our young budding scientists. David Lindrum, thank you very much.
Yeah. Think about doing it next year. Any young people, you know, if you have students who are coming into the high school, encourage them.
It's no longer
required.
Absolutely.
But really, encourage your kids to take part in this. It's so exciting.
Right.
Thanks, Pat.
You bet, Dave.
Thank you.
Well, a little less stormy weather because they finally lifted that storm warning. Tomorrow on the show, you'll hear a story about a new writing group with guest Jennifer Walker. We'll talk about the director of a new surfing movie, Splinters, showing next week in Goldtown and the week at Eagle Crest. KTOO broadcasts on translators throughout the area. K276 AF is at 103.1, K269 AO at 101.7, K201 AM 88.1, K220 BT at 91.9, and K210 AS at 89.9.